touch that third rail that is the UFO phenomenon?
Well, as you say, I've been writing military fiction for about 20 years or so, but I've always been interested in UFOs. Even since I was a kid, I used to read everything I could get my hands on about UFOs. So, I don't know. Just one day, the two genres, let's say, kind of met in my mind, and it just seemed like I had read a lot of instances where, which would lead one to conclude maybe that UFOs show up more frequently during wartime or when we're about to go to war. So I thought about that for a while, and I brought it up in a conversation with my editor one day, and he said, you know, that might not be a bad idea to look into doing a book, but it would have to be a nonfiction book, which I hadn't written a nonfiction book in 20 years. So we went through the process, and that was about 2 years ago, and you know, the book came out about a month ago. So that's the short version.
Okay. So the general consensus is that modern UFO era, anyway, began with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947. But your book seems to demonstrate that it started years, in fact, centuries before that.
Yes, that's right. We have we start the book off with a kind of a short chapter on sightings of UFOs during wartime, stretching back hundreds, even thousands of years. The first episode we get into is that we came upon a report that Alexander the Great in 300 B.C., in the middle of one of his campaigns, was crossing a river in eastern Persia, and with a huge army, which included a lot of cavalry and war elephants. And as they're about to ford this strategic river, these, as they described them, flaming shields came out of the sky and scared the elephants and the horses to the point where they would not cross the river. So you have this instance where you had UFOs actually influencing the outcome of a military campaign. Then 2 years later, Alexander's army was laying siege to the city of Tyre, which is in present-day Lebanon. It was a city that was built in a harbor. And they were about to attack the city, and the shields showed up again. And one of them, as the story goes, sent a lightning bolt down to one of the walls of the city and destroyed it, and allowed Alexander's troops to go in and take the city. So two kind of interesting stories from way back when.
Now, I've heard that particular one I had heard before, and I often wonder, was the occupants of the UFO on Alexander's side or not? If they were on Alexander's side, why didn't they just zap the enemy? Why do they knock the wall down?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those questions. You know, I mean, there's 100. Thousands of questions, you know, that come up when you're researching a book like this. Why do they do the things they do? And there's no good answers. We can only speculate.
Now, what I speculate on that is maybe the occupants were, you know, knocking the wall down between the two armies, saying, "Knock it off, you guys."
that could be too.
You know, what's the point here? So, give our listeners a couple of examples of UFOs in wartime, other than Alexander.
Well, you know, another instance that goes back to 300 A.D. It has to do with Constantine the First. He was about to go to battle with a rival just outside Rome, and whoever won the battle was going to become the next emperor of Rome. He was outnumbered, but the day before the battle, he and his troops saw a UFO in the sky. It was shaped like a cross, and that told him there was seers that were with his army, accompanying him. They told him that what that meant was if his troops painted crosses on their shields, that they would win the battle the next day. So he ordered his troops to do this, and they did win the battle, even though they were underdogs, and Constantine became the Emperor of Rome, and one of the first things he did was make the Christian religion the official religion of Rome. So, in an odd way, you could look at it as the reason that the Christian religion proliferated, first in the Roman Empire and then around the world, could have been because of a UFO sighting. Then down through the Middle Ages, there was numbers of UFO sightings during the years of the Black Plague. In Germany, people saw what in Nuremberg in the early 1300s, I believe, they saw what could only be described as a battle in the sky. Just right up until the 20th century, which is really the book really takes off, so to speak, with the beginning of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would appear that someone has an interest in our petty wars, eh?
I really believe that. I really believe that, no one knows what UFOs are. We know they exist, we just don't know what they are. And it just seems to me that after doing this, I mean, when I first started, I thought that maybe more people see UFOs in wartime because, especially in the 20th century, when we have now aerial warfare involved, there are more people, you know, flying in airplanes, there are more people in the sky, there are more opportunities to see other things flying in the sky, more people on the ground looking up at the sky. But as I kind of went along with the research, it really seemed to me that these things really are watching us when we're at war or when we're ready to go to war. If we can just, you know, shoot ahead to the instances of the Foo Fighters during World War II. Mm. There were hundreds of instances reported by Allied bomber crews, both in the European theater and the Pacific theater, of seeing these strange objects following them and following them right into battle and being riding right alongside them as they were bombing cities in Germany and in the Pacific theater. And my only thought I could come up with at the end of doing this research is, if you have the ability to have these fantastic machines that UFOs can describe to be, fly at fantastic speeds, do fantastic maneuvering, and so on and so forth, why would you ride off the 200 feet off the wing of a B-17 bomber when it's bombing some German city, if only just to watch history in the making?
Yeah. I wondered if our history is that important to E.T.
Well, I believe that I don't believe they're E.T.s, to tell you the truth.
Really? Okay.
I think, and again, this is just something that came to me while in the 2 years I was working on this, is I think there could be a good case to be made that these are actually time travelers from our own future,
mm-hmm.
coming back to see our history as it's being made.
Hmm. Well, you know, they have, that's a good theory. In fact, I wrote a book on that theory itself. But abductees, I don't know what your opinion is of the abduction phenomenon, but go ahead.
Well,
what is your opinion?
Here's a funny story, because as I'm writing this, writing the book and doing the research, in my office I always have the TV on, and the sound's always turned down, but for some reason I just always have the TV on. So while I was doing this, for some reason it was turned to the Animal Planet channel a lot, and, you know, those are usually what they show on those shows are, you know, people going out into the wilds of Africa and watching lions eating antelopes and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So it dawned on me, too, that, you know, there's a chance that maybe UFOs are actually, you know, like tourists from the future. I mean, if you want a safari today, I mean, what would you do? You would have to fly a long way to Africa. They would put you in a truck with a camera, and you'd go out into the Serengeti, and, you know, you would see the lions eating the antelopes and the crocodiles eating this and that. And these animals, they would see you in the truck, they would see the truck, but they can't comprehend what a truck is, what a tourist is, what a camera is, so they just go on in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the same with us. I mean, we see UFOs all the time. There are thousands of UFOs reported, or at least hundreds reported every day. They're not trying to hide. They're just hit there. And we go about our daily lives because maybe we just can't comprehend what they are, just like the lion can't comprehend what a tourist is. So if you take that one step further, you know, there are people who go out on these safaris or you know, research people who go out and they shoot animals with the tranquilizer guns and they study them and then they let them go. So that's not that far away from what some abductees report. So
right.
Who knows? You know, I mean, I look at it as like a big puzzle where we get a piece every once in a while that doesn't fit here but might fit there and so on.
Right.
And maybe someday all the pieces of the puzzle will all fit together. We'll know what's going on.
Right. But what I was thinking of was the fact that these abductees report these gray beings with big black eyes and oversized heads or praying mantis-type beings, all different kinds of beings, some very very much like ourselves.
Right,
what they call the Nordics. But if they are time travelers, unless we're talking about the Nordics, what happened in evolution that made our species look like that?
Well, there is a branch of biology, and I can't think of the name of it right now. And it's not a large branch, but it is a branch that they look into the theory that as a species grows older over thousands and even millions of years, that they start to revert back to, frankly, what the fetus-like state looks like. So in a way that would account for the grays, because in a way they do look kind of fetus-like. As far as the Nordics, maybe they're from a different they're from an earlier time in our future. I don't know. I mean, it's funny because a lot of people, the general person on the street always thinks of flying saucers in the same sentence as little green men from Mars, and you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be that explanation.
No, that's true. I've heard many people say I don't think they're extraterrestrial, and I respect that. You know, but if not extraterrestrial, or if not other dimensional, then what? You know?
And yeah, that's the $64,000 question.
Yeah, right. And time travel is very, very possible. But it just, I don't know about our evolution. You know, what examples did they give examples as to which species has reverted to fetus-like condition?
No, beats me. I just barely made it out of high school biology, so I really don't know. But I did read that at one point, and I thought that was fascinating, and that it did kind of connect to what people described the grays as looking like.
Well, that would make sense if they could cite a species, any species, that would be a good example for that. You know what I'm saying? But, well, I don't know. It's very possible. It's very possible. Another theory is other dimensional.
Right. Could be other dimensions, inner space. It could be from some place that we have no idea what it is, where it is, when it is.
Right, right. Well, you know, all of these X-rays and gamma rays and neutrinos, they're all around us right now. Ultraviolet, infrared. Mm-hmm. We can't see them without certain paraphernalia, equipment, and then, you know, it translates it to our visual light spectrum. So there could be an infrared, ultraviolet, or some other dimensional beings or world right here in our midst. Am I correct?
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, the latest theory on physics, if you watch, the Discovery Channel, which is, you know, about as far as my education of these things go, is that, you know, for everything to kind of make sense in the universe, from Einstein on up, there has to be other dimensions that we just aren't aware of, but that just takes, you know, that answers a lot of questions as, you know, why the universe is expanding and going faster than it should and things of that nature. So hopefully we'll find out maybe with this collider in that they have going over in Europe, they're going to find out these things. Who knows? But I hope they find them out, you know, in our lifetime.
I can't see what the how the collider would help. Can you?
Well, you know, they're having trouble with that collider. I don't know if you saw that recently. They're having trouble with things that they're calling UFOs in that collider.
Really?
They started it up about 2 years ago, and then it broke down very mysteriously, like about 2 weeks later. And now, when they got it cranked up again, they're being plagued by these things that they call UFOs, but it's for unidentified floating objects. And apparently when they slam these atoms into each other to make them break apart to see what the elementary particles are, that they're having these unidentified floating objects that are kind of obscuring what they want to see. So there were people who thought a couple years ago, in fact, there were a couple scientific papers written about this, that when the thing mysteriously broke down after they started up the first time, they thought that there was possibly a message from people in the future saying this is something that you shouldn't do. But now they've fixed it, and now they have this other weird problem. So, you know, who knows? I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about. But I just read that the other day, that they're being plagued by their own brand of UFOs.
I'll be darned. Well, the floating objects are where? Within the this tube that they're trying to...
The tubes where they smash the atoms into each other, and then they take a photograph of it
right
at that very moment, and they think that by taking that photograph that they're going to see elementary particles, which, you know, were present at the 1 trillionth second after the Big Bang. Well, these important things that they're trying to zero in on are being obscured by their version of UFOs.
It's very possible that, you know, it's very possible whether they're ETs or our future beings, whoever, is trying to tell us, you know, the kids have found the matches, and knock it off. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, when you look at the instances of UFO incursions over ICM bases in the 60s and 70s, and now apparently continuing today,
right.
You know, where they've been spotted over missile silos, and they've shut the things down, have retargeted some, you know, of the missiles in the Ukraine. In the 80s, they had a UFO appeared over a missile base and started the launch procedure. I mean, if those aren't warnings, I don't know what they are.
That's true. We're going to get back to that in just a second, but I need to take a second to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves here in Dearborn, Michigan. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with the researcher and author, Mac Maloney, author of UFOs in Wartime, What They Didn't Want You to Know. And What They Didn't Want You to Know, very often, as you know, in virtually everything I've studied, and again in your book, every time somebody has these sightings, the military have these sightings, and many, 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 Army, Navy, Marines, you name it, have had these sightings. They're told, keep your mouth shut about it. Am I right?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, that's rule number one in the military when it comes to this. The one thing the military is good at is covering things up. they know how to do that. And a lot of times it's just telling people, you know, people in the lower ranks, never talk about this again. And I think it's to the credit of the U.S. military that, you know, time after time we come upon these stories where there are hundreds of people out there who have seen things that they've been told not to talk about, and they haven't talked about them. And it's only the virtual handful that have talked about it that we know that these stories, that these things have happened. But it's in the military, for whatever reason, it's in the military, they believe it's in their best interest not to tell us everything they know about UFOs. But, you know, I can guarantee you, and this is no bold promise, but I can guarantee you that the U.S. military knows a lot more about UFOs than they're letting on.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a survey, several surveys about, do you think that we're being visited? Do you believe in UFOs? Have you ever seen one? That type of thing. Over 50% believe we're being visited. Now, be that ET or other dimensional time travelers, we're being visited by another civilization. They believe that. And yet, when they're asked, do you think the government knows more than they are telling us about the UFO phenomenon? Over 90% say yes. Well, okay, 50% believe we're being visited. Or over 50%, let's say 55% believe we're being visited. But how can the rest of them say, no, I don't think we're being visited, but the government knows more about UFOs than they're letting on?
Right. Doesn't make sense.
That doesn't make sense. So I think that they're kind of afraid to, even though it's their name is out of it, they're being kept anonymous, they're a little gun-shy of saying, yes, I believe we're being visited, or yes, I have had a sighting, had something weird happen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right? I mean, that's the it's the military way. You know, I mean, as I said before, if you're told to keep your mouth shut on no matter what it is, you know, most of the people will do that. You know, but it's also an instance where For instance, airline pilots. I've talked to airline pilots, and they're all, most of them are ex-military pilots. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell you stories that'll make your hair curl, but only off the record, because it's the same thing. They know if they go on the record that their career is in jeopardy. Same thing in the military. So there's a lot of information out there, and people will tell you that, hey, you know, I'll tell you this off the record, but to get people to speak on the record is very, very hard.
Well, curl our hair, curl our listeners' hair, and share one of these stories with us.
Well, one of the stories that I think is just, you know, hair curling is in the early 50s. There was an incident where a Navy version of a Super Constellation airliner was flying from Europe back to the United States, and it was full with military personnel at the end of their tour of duty and flying back home. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were air crews. So this airplane was about 90 minutes outside of Gander, Newfoundland, when the pilot saw lights shining on the ocean below. And the first thing he thought was, oh, boy, that's a city, and we're way off course. Mm-hmm. But then he talked to his navigator, and the navigator said, nope, you know, we're right on course. And they couldn't figure out what all these lights were floating on the surface of the ocean. So the pilot actually called up a number of these air crews that were just writing his passages, and all these people kind of crowded in the cockpit of this plane and were looking at these lights when suddenly a ring of these lights came up from the ocean surface, and within seconds was right next to the plane, and it was it wasn't a ring of lights at all. It was an enormous saucer-shaped object, and the pilot had to veer away to avoid colliding with this thing. He was successful in doing that, and this thing rode alongside of the airplane for, you know, almost a minute or so. Now, these people are, like I said, a number of air crews, they're veterans, military veterans, flyers, saw this thing, and then it disappeared. So now the airplane lands finally in Gander, and there are Air Force intelligence people waiting for them. They debrief all these people. They're all Navy people on this plane. They debrief them, and then the plane and its crew follows on to Pax River down in Maryland, to the Navy base down there, where they're debriefed again. Now, a few weeks later, a government scientist gets in touch with the pilot and says that he's been cleared to have a conversation with him about what happened. So they have this conversation, and the scientist basically just re-questions him, debriefs him about what happened. And at the end of this meeting, the scientist pulled out a portfolio of photographs, and he said to the pilot, now which one of these objects did you see? And now this pilot is confronted with about a dozen different shapes photographs of UFOs, and there's a photograph of exactly what he saw. And he said, this is what we saw, but I demand you tell me how do you have these photographs. And the scientist just said, I can't tell you, picked up his portfolio and left. So, I mean, there's an example of where you have not just one air crew, but you have a number of veteran military people seeing this gigantic object, and then, a very credible story, in my opinion, that the U.S. Military knew what this thing was, had photographs of it, and is not letting on that they know.
Yeah. They say, well, with all these cameras out there, we should have photographs of these things if people see them so often, and especially with the cell phones now, we're getting a lot of photographs. Some you see on YouTube are obviously hoaxes, paint shop and what have you. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of photographs, especially the McMinnville. I think you're familiar with the McMinnville, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
The Trents. Very simple people.
Mm-hmm.
Take this picture of this object in the sky. And there are a lot of pictures of, but, you know, the debunkers just say, oh, I can do that on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, maybe you can, but a lot of these people, most of these people, 90% of these people did not do that on their computer. So make sure.
Right. And when you look at some of the people who have these photographs, you say, well, what purpose would they want to perpetuate a hoax?
Yeah.
Here?
Yeah. And then they end up being sorry that they brought it to the world's attention because they're accused of being a hoaxer, you know?
Well, you know, that's a program that was put in place by the CIA in the early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they had the incident where UFO showed up twice over Washington, D.C. in the early 50s in August, one summer, two weekends during August, they had a number of UFO sightings over the White House, over the Capitol building, over Andrews Air Force Base, over the National Airport. And what happened was this made such headlines that so many people called the White House and called the Pentagon that the telephone lines were actually jammed and no calls could get in or out. And so that's when the CIA became involved in the whole UFO question, and they said, you know, we don't know what they are, or that's what they said, but what we have to put an end to is people taking this so seriously that they call the Pentagon and they call the White House. If there is ever UFO, if the Russians were ever able to create a UFO flap like that, they could basically make us, you know, not be able to use any kind of communications, and that would be the perfect scenario for them to have some kind of a first strike on us. So the CIA went out of its way to basically make a program with the help of the military that anyone who reports a UFO should be looked upon as like a hoaxer or someone who's delusional or someone who should be, you know, the object of derision. And that's even now, today. If people say they see a UFO, there's a certain percentage of people out there who think they're crazy.
Well,
so
certainly.
It's almost embedded in our DNA now that, you know, that you question what people see, yet UFOs are seen hundreds of them every day around the world.
Well, sure, sure. And when you mentioned hundreds, I remember a story in your book where military personnel were outdoors. This was in Vietnam, I believe. Yeah, it was in Vietnam. And they were watching an outdoor movie when a UFO. Tell us about that.
Well, it happened in 1966 and at a lodge base along the coast of Vietnam. And what had happened was that they had just got a outdoor generator. So they were able to show an outdoor movie for the first time ever. So you had about 5,000 people gathered around this movie theater, outdoor movie theater, let's say. And also, at the time, you had there was an air base connected to this larger base, and there were two airplanes getting ready to take off on a night mission. And then to the south, there were a couple bulldozers that were making a road, creating a new road in the jungle. So you have all this activity going on. And it was about 10 o'clock at night. The movie was about half over when this extremely bright light came down on top, right on top of where the people were watching the movie. And thousands of people saw it. At first they thought it was a flare, but then they knew that, you know, this was no flare because it just hung in the air over them, and it lit up the entire base. Now, the odd thing was that as soon as it appeared, the generator shut down, the airplanes on the runway, their engines shut off, the bulldozers could no longer move. It just killed all power to this huge base. And this is in front of thousands of people, and it hung there for, you know, several minutes and then took off. The next day, the people from the original NICAP arrived, and they interviewed some people. And then, of course, the military intelligence people interviewed some people. And once again, they never figured out what it was, but it's probably one of the largest largest number of witnesses to a sighting, especially, at least in Vietnam, if not in all of UFO history.
You say there are 5,000 people.
Right.
Good Lord. So how do they keep 5,000 people quiet?
Well, you know, they didn't, because we have the story. The story has been around.
Good point. But, I mean, you know, I guess it's a rhetorical question. How do you keep 5,000 people quiet about something as traumatic as that, you know?
I think it's just, in Vietnam, one thing that we lead off the chapter about Vietnam is that all the stories from Vietnam are different from all the other stories that we dealt with.
Mm.
The stories from Vietnam, and because it was just such a strange war, if you know what I mean, and a lot of things went on in that war that you know, were just really strange and off kilter, and it wasn't your typical war anyway. So it just seems for some reason the stories from Vietnam are like that. They're off kilter. They're just really very, very strange, and that's one of them.
Well, isn't it a good point for skeptics to say, especially about Vietnam, there's a lot of drug use and marijuana being smoked in Vietnam, and people are seeing all kinds of things probably. Is that a valid point?
I think so. I really do, and we bring out that point that, you know, the Vietnam War, as you know, it wasn't your typical kind of battle line war, you know. It was a war that we would just fly troops into the jungle. We would try to kill more of them than they killed of us, and whoever had the highest body count was able to kind of declare victory.
Yeah.
So you weren't really there to win a war like you were like in World War II. You only served a year in country. If you can make it through that 365 days, you're out. So you're not really fighting to win anything. You're just fighting to stay alive. So as you say, there was a lot of drug use. There was a lot of low morale problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an unpopular war. So I think that when you combine all that and into not just marijuana either, there was a lot of heavy, you know, heroin use and things like that, it creates this soup where all this strange stuff comes out. And as I say, most of the stories from Vietnam are strange. However, if I could just take a minute to tell the Hobart story, which isn't a strange story at all. I mean, not strange in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the late 60s where they saw UFOs over the DMZ, which was the demarcation line between the Communist North and the, you know, non-Communist South.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. military, as usual, didn't want to say they were UFOs, so they referred to them as enemy helicopters. But the Communists, the North Vietnamese or Viet Cong, never had helicopters during the Vietnam War. So these things started showing up on a regular basis. So they moved a lot of anti-aircraft batteries up to the DMZ. They asked a lot of ships to patrol right off the coast of the DMZ. And they also brought forward a lot of F-4 fighters to check these things out when they showed up. So one night, people started reporting these things in the sky. The F-4s took off, started chasing these things, chased them out over the Gulf of Tonkin, and fired on them. And the missiles wound up hitting the HMAS Hobart, which was an Australian warship, and killing four Australian sailors. The Australians shot back at the F-4s. This is the middle of the night, confusion of war, fog of battle, and so on. It wasn't until the next morning that people figured out what had happened. And it was just tragic outcome, which later on was laid right to the feet of F-4s chasing UFOs.
Yeah. Let me take one more break here just to remind our listeners you're listening to WHFR.FM, 89.3 FM on your radio, WHFR.FM on your computers. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Mac Maloney, researcher and author of many fictional wartime stories based on fact, and at least one book, nonfiction, UFOs in Wartime, What They Didn't Want You to Know. Now, we were talking about firing upon each other. That was with conventional weapons because of UFOs. The same thing almost happened with nuclear weapons between U.S. and Russia. Am I correct?
Right. I mean, there's a long chapter, several chapters, in fact, that details this, what I called in the book America's Second Missile Crisis. We had the missile crisis of 1962, in which Russia put nuclear missiles in Cuba, and we almost went to war over them having those missiles there and refusing to take them out.
Mm-hmm.
But later on in the 60s and then on to the 70s, we had this other missile crisis, which I think was much more dangerous, but it's been kept secret for the most part. And what it was we started putting these ICBMs in silos built all over the middle part of the country, out in these vast plains of South Dakota, North Dakota, Colorado, places like that. And as soon as these things started becoming operational, UFOs started showing up over them with great frequency. And it was a pattern that was followed no matter where these bases were. The UFOs would show up, and they would hover or fly over these missile silos, which were very, very isolated, and either shut down the power in them or they would do something with the targeting system, or both, and sometimes they would actually do something to affect the warhead itself. The warhead had to be taken out and replaced and so on. This went on for, well, it went on for almost 15 to 20 years. In fact, I just read the other day that they're still having problems with some of these ICBM bases. There's an author named Robert Hastings who has written the book, the Bible on this, called UFO and Nukes. Yeah. He's done a tremendous amount of research, and he really is the godfather of this particular aspect of UFO history. But it's really frightening because, first of all, in one case, at a place called Maelstrom Air Force Base, they knocked out 150 of these missiles, you know, over the course of several days. They knocked out 15 of them in the course of one night. Now, here's a situation where we are counting on this massive nuclear retaliation to keep the Russians from, at the time, from, you know, bombarding us with nuclear missiles. If you have a large part of your nuclear deterrent unexpectedly offline at any given time, that's a huge security breach, and it can only be laid to the feet of these UFOs showing up. So that whole chapter is really pretty frightening, and like I said, Robert Hastings goes into it in much more detail than we do, but it's scary. It's a scary part of the book, frankly.
Yeah, we had Robert Hastings on this show, in fact. We Are Not Alone, and a while back here, and he told some pretty scary stories about these new... In fact, UFO sightings really picked up after the first atomic test, and they tend to be seen over many nuclear facilities, and not only the warheads, but nuclear power plants as well. And you see a connection there, obviously.
I do. I mean, the nuclear fuel for right at the tail end of World War II, when the military went ahead and started making more nuclear weapons, was made at a place called the Hanford Nuclear Research Site out in Washington State. And just in 1945 alone, they had, you know, a dozen or so UFO sightings over this plant where, like you say, it's not the weapons themselves, it's processing the fuel to make the weapons.
Right.
So, you know, once again, it gets back to this thing where this idea that this apparent idea that these things are looking in on us, especially when we're at war or what appears to be preparing for war. During the 1950s, there were thousands of UFO sightings across this country, and a lot of those had to do, you know, were sighted over military bases. We go into great detail about what happened during the 50s, and that was a Cold War in which we were in this position of we were constantly ready to go to war, people who remember those days. It seemed like we were going to be at war with Russia, you know, any day.
Oh, yeah.
And these UFOs, they were just everywhere. They were everywhere. And you know, once again, like I say, it's a big puzzle. Hopefully we can put all these pieces together at some point and figure out what's going on. And I hope it happens in our lifetime. I mean, it would be a great mystery solved, and it would be a huge, you know, to find out the answer to these things would be a huge step in our human development. I think it would be one of the greatest discoveries ever.
Yeah, it would be. How do you think people would take it, the general public?
I think this is one of the reasons why we're not being told the whole truth. I think that civilization as we know it, it might not collapse, but it's going to change radically. And I think one of the things that would change a lot is religion. There's a story in the book that Winston Churchill was shown a photograph of a Foo Fighter, very detailed photograph of one of these things following a British reconnaissance plane during World War II. And the first thing he did was embargo that photograph, he said, for 50 years, but it still hasn't come out. Because he was afraid that if people thought that there were other things out there besides us, that especially religion, which kind of holds civilization together, would collapse, because where does religion go if our religions, all the religions on this planet, are based on this planet, they're relative to this planet? Well, if there are other people out there, other beings out there floating around, coming here, visiting us, where does that put our religion?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, like it or not, religion kind of binds us together. Well, if that starts to fall apart, the consequences are untold. I think that a lot of people, depending on how UFOs are, let's say, finally discovered. If a UFO lands on the White House lawn, as everyone always likes to say, you know, I think that would be different than if, like, one crashed and we came upon it and we could verify that this was something not of this era. But I think it would be huge ramifications for our civilization, just like there was huge ramifications for the Native Americans when Columbus hit our shores. It's untold what it could do to us, but I don't think it's going to be any party, frankly.
No. As to religious ramifications, people are going to ask themselves, what exactly was Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel that came down from the sky? You know, right. What was Moses' pillar of cloud and pillar of smoke?
Right.
What were all these things that came down from the sky? And
What was the light the three kings followed?
Right. That's right. In fact, I wrote a book myself called UFO Jesus Connection, and where I deal with that. It's a touchy subject. But at the same time, is there a connection? Was there a connection? You tell a story in your book about the giant that saved this guy in Vietnam, this soldier in Vietnam. Tell us that one.
Well, you know, when we researched the book, it was basically a process of distilling lots and lots of stories down into about 70 episodes that we have in the book, and we probably had 250, and we just had to keep kind of editing down and figuring out which ones to put in the book. And there were just a handful of stories that are just too good not to have put in, and this is one of them. And the story is that, you know, once again, as we were saying, the way the Vietnam War worked was they would put army troops on helicopters, fly them into the middle of enemy territory, try to get into a firefight with the communists, and try to kill more of them than they killed of us. So it was one of these helicopter assault missions where crewmen on a helicopter landed during one of these battles, and the battle was ongoing when this helicopter landed, and they landed in a grassy field, and in the middle of all this the firefight, a fire had actually broken out on the landing zone. So the commander of the crew chief of the helicopter told this crewman to go back and help the helicopter behind them, which had caught on fire. So this guy takes a fire extinguisher, not a rifle, but a fire extinguisher, runs back to this helicopter. By the time he got back there, the crew of the helicopter had taken care of the problem and had taken off. Now this guy's disoriented, and he doesn't know where he is. He's in the middle of a firefight in the middle of a fire. Suddenly he sees this communist soldier who is about to shoot him, but then this third figure appears and shoots the communist soldier. When the American turned around, he saw this gigantic soldier in a uniform with a helmet, not an American uniform, but some kind of uniform, some kind of helmet, some kind of weapon, who had just saved his life. And then the American took the opportunity to, you know, get back to his helicopter, got on the helicopter, took off, got out of there safely. As they were flying away, they saw the dead communist soldier's body, but no sign of the giant. Now, again, I thought that this story was, you know, one of these things that, you know, came, a strange story came from a strange war, but I just saw yesterday that during the funeral of the leader of North Korea who had just died, Kim Il-jung, I think his name is, in the crowd you can see this gigantic soldier. So when I saw that, I said, well, maybe this isn't a crazy story after all.
Now, you see, I was talking about religious ramifications. This story made me think, now, a very religious person would say, that was an angel that came and saved his life. Because it certainly sounds like, you know, an angel story, or something that the religious...
Well, there's a lot of, if you really look into it, there's a lot of, you know, UFO sightings and people who have come into contact with who they believe are occupants of UFOs that are very much like angel sightings.
Yeah?
It could very well be all part of one whole thing.
And there's a lot of angel sightings or heavenly, you know, chariots of fire sightings in religious canon that sound very much like UFO stories.
Right. I mean, there's a good chance that it's more connected than we think.
Yeah. On October 8th, 1955, the New York Times quoted General Douglas MacArthur as saying, "Because of the developments of science, all the countries of Earth will have to unite to survive and make a common front against attack by people from other planets. The politics of the future will be cosmic or interplanetary. Do you think that that comment was prompted because of the Foo Fighters sightings in World War II?
It could very well be. A lot of people think that the Foo Fighters were just confined to the European theater of war, but thanks to a writer named Keith Chester, who wrote a book called Strange Company a few years ago, and he and I have kind of become friends over the phone and through email because we leaned on his book a lot for the Foo Fighters section. He is the one who came out and pushed the whole UFO era, not from Kenneth Arnold's sightings, but back into World War II, where it should be. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who also revealed with a lot of good facts that substantiated with facts is that Foo Fighters showed up a lot over the Pacific, and of course that's where MacArthur was. I could see during the 50s people thinking along those lines because, you know, these things were showing up. We're in Cold War jitters as it is.
Right.
You know, maybe MacArthur, I mean, if someone made a statement like that today, I'm not sure how it would be taken. But back in the 50s, I could see people saying, well, of course, the next step is that we're going to be invaded from people from outer space. So, you know, that's an, I'd never heard that statement before. That's an interesting comment that he made.
Right. This was General Douglas MacArthur who made that. Yeah, and also, I guess Truman was not all that worried about UFOs until they overflew Washington, overflew the White House, where he, you know, well, here there goes the neighborhood.
Right,
and,
right.
And well, he gave the order to shoot him down.
That's right. I mean, that was another thing that got people so concerned that they flooded the Pentagon and the White House telephone lines. You know, they, after those two weekends in August, 52, where the UFOs showed up over D.C., Truman gave a secret order, which didn't stay secret for very long, to all U.S. military pilots, and the order was is that if you come upon a UFO and you can't, quote-unquote, talk him down, then shoot it down. And they never got into the details of how you talk one down. But when people heard that, they got so upset because they said, you know what, these things, let's face it, they're of a technology way higher than us. We probably shouldn't be shooting at them because they might start shooting back, and you'll be in a position of what Douglas MacArthur was talking about, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. But I should think that they have the ability to just take off and get out of our way, you know.
In some cases, we do have a story at the very end of the book that took place during the first Gulf War where, once again, it was one of these stories that kept coming back to us. It kept popping up, so we had to put it in there, where an F-16 supposedly shot down a flying saucer over the Saudi Arabian desert.
Hmm.
And the debris was recovered by the Army, U.S. Army, but there were people who saw this debris before the U.S. military got there. So very few instances in the book of where the UFOs take offensive action against anybody. But there are a handful in there where they do kind of shoot at us and we shoot back.
Hmm. So the thought is, if you see a UFO, don't shoot at the darn thing.
I wouldn't shoot at one.
And also don't flash a flashlight at it. That's
right.
You hear a lot of stories about, you know, oh, I just saw this thing and I flashed my headlights, I flashed my flashlight. Next thing I know, I was inside the ship on a gurney or whatever. So that might not be a good idea.
Right.
But now, as an author of fiction, are you afraid that authoring a book on such a controversial subject as UFOs might adversely affect your credibility?
No, I don't think so. Because, first of all, with the number, I've written like 30 novels and military action novels, and a few of them have actually dealt with UFOs. I don't really see myself as a UFO researcher. I just see myself more as a reporter, reporting these bits of evidence and bits of research that we came upon, which kind of you know, went in line with our theory that UFOs show up a lot during wartime or when we're about to go to war.
Right.
I haven't had any reaction saying, well, you're a fiction writer, therefore there must be fictional elements to this. It's written kind of in a different style, but I don't think it's going to affect my credibility. I haven't heard that mentioned to me yet, so I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Really? Really? You know, Leslie Kane, you're probably familiar with her. Leslie Kane is a journalist and wrote the book on on pilots and...
generals and generals. Yeah, great book.
Come forward. And, you know, there are a lot of whistleblowers out there and top-notch people who are coming forward saying, yeah, we are being visited by someone or something. And they seem to be under intelligent control. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be interested in our petty wars, seem to be interested really in our nuclear facilities. And, you know, that's scary because the nuclear weapons are scary enough. But to have someone, no matter whether it's E.T. or from our own future, messing with them, that really adds an element of fear as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you're right. I mean, the question people ask me is, what do you think the U.S. military knows? And my response always is, they know more than they're letting on, but what is it that they know or they don't know? Do they know what UFOs are and they're keeping that from us? Or they don't know what they are, and they, therefore they can't protect us from them, and that's what they don't want us to know. So
yeah.
It's kind of like 50-50. I'm not sure. But either way, you know, there's scary elements to either side.
Right, especially in the abduction phenomena. You know, they can't come out and say, yeah, we know you guys are being abducted by these guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, but there's nothing we can do about it, so leave us alone.
Well, see, that's the last thing they would say, you know. That's the last thing they would say, that we're the huge, you know, U.S. military, and we can't protect you from these things. Mm-hmm. They would rather cover it up than to come out and make that statement.
That's right. I think that's the underlying reason behind their reluctance, but... France, Belgium, Mexico, and others that are more open about the UFO data, and they criticize America for not following suit. But do you think that there'll ever come to a point where the U.S. will be willing to share with its citizens the material that they do have on the subject?
No. Nope. I just don't see it ever happening. The U.S. military just isn't in the business of revealing something that it doesn't have to reveal. I know that there was that a petition that was made to Obama a little while ago where they asked if he knew of any instance where the U.S. government has been in contact with extraterrestrials. Mm. And he had one of the science advisors come out and say, yeah, no, we've never been in contact with extraterrestrials. Well, going back to what I was saying earlier, I think the question was wrong. I think they should have said, is there any evidence that the U.S. government has been in contact with intelligent beings other than the human race? Ask that question and see if someone will answer that truthfully. If you have someone to answer that truthfully, then you've kicked open a door that can't be closed again. But I can guarantee you it won't be the U.S. military. They're the worst people to be in charge of investigating UFOs. Scientists should be in charge of investigating UFOs, not the U.S. military. They're too adept at keeping secrets, and you don't want the people who are good at keeping secrets looking into UFOs.
But don't you think it's the scientists that are even more afraid of people finding out that what they've been saying and what they've been poo-pooing all this time is real?
Well, certain scientists, for sure, but you know, the thing is, too, is that, you know, if you're a scientist and you start investigating UFOs, you're going to be like the airline pilot who starts telling people he's seeing UFOs in flight. But the thing is that if you fund scientific research into UFOs, which has never been done in this country, I mean, they spend $10 billion on this collider over in Europe to see, you know, what we were talking about, the elementary particles of the Big Bang. What would happen if they put $10 billion into the research of finding out what UFOs are? I talked to Jerry Clark a number of times during the, you know, researching of the book, and I asked him when he thought the UFO puzzle would be solved. And he thinks in about 40 years that the climate will be right, that scientists will be given the funding and therefore the legitimacy to go and look into the UFOs. And he feels that it probably won't take that long once you have this kind of concerted effort to look into it. I hope he's right. I hope he's right, but I hope he's off in his timeline. I hope it happens a little bit sooner than that. But the way we conclude the book is saying when that time comes, and someone will do it. It might not be Americans, frankly. It could be the Chinese scientists that wind up doing this or Indian scientists. But when they do it, just don't put the military involved. Put civilian scientists involved, and finally I think we'll get some square answers.
Yeah. Mac Maloney, where can we go to find out more about your work?
Well, the book is published by Penguin Books, and so it's in every bookstore across the country, U.S. and Canada. You can go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com to order it, and I have a website, MacMaloney.com, that has information about the book and other books I've done. So there's a lot of places where the book can be, where more information can be got about the book.
Very good. Mac Maloney, thank you so much for joining us today. And best of continued success with your writing and this particular book.
Great. Thanks a lot, Dave. I really enjoyed being here. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on the talk shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, UFOImplications.com. That's UFOImplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. And please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
What do your status updates say? You're learning a new language? Going all organic? Instead of typing your feelings, what if you could put them into action? By creating a network to help keep kids off the streets, in a country like Armenia, or in Honduras, bringing IT into the classroom, or on a farm in Tanzania, helping stem the world's food crisis by creating a sustainable agricultural program. What if every ounce of your being helped update the status of a person, and in turn they did the same for you? Would this be enough social interaction? Or is this only the beginning of something larger? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. Get interactive at peacecorps.gov/game.
Hey, WHFR listeners, I'm Dennis.
And I'm Lindsay.
And we're your hosts for a new talk show here at Henry Ford Community College called HFCC's Campus Connection.
That's right. From 1 to 2 p.m. on the second Tuesday of every month, Dennis and I will cover the news, issues, and events here on the campus of HFCC and talk about how they relate to the surrounding communities.
Basically, we bring you all the news we think you want to know about our college and our station, WHFR.
We talk about the fantastic restaurant we have right here on campus.
And upcoming performances of HFCC plays and musicals.
We'll even keep you posted on the success of our various sports teams.
In fact, we fill you in on all of the campus activities open to the public, many of them absolutely free.
So when it comes to Henry Ford Community College news,
make the connection.
The HFCC Campus Connection. On 89.3 FM from 1 to 2 p.m. on the second Tuesday of every month.
That's WHFR.FM.
The station making waves.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
ever have this conversation with yourself?
Local news and alternative views.
I know. You don't know. I know what I need to know. You don't know enough. I read news on the internet. You don't know local. I check into Facebook a lot. You don't know facts. I watch television news. You don't know in depth. I read the local newspapers. Better, but you still don't know background analysis, the real voices of the newsmakers. Then what should I do to really know local news and alternative views? You need to listen to the new WHFR Journal, broadcast live Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on WHFR 89.3 FM, or get their podcast from www.whfr.fm. So,
now I'll know.
Hi, this is Pat Frisco from the Spirits Rejoice radio program with another thought to consider. The creative artist has always worked outside the box. The truly creative artist has a unique perspective, a unique voice. Their works of art go beyond what a painting is supposed to look like, or a jazz or classical piece is supposed to sound like. As a result, these artists are often overlooked, underpaid, or totally neglected. Just look across the radio dial. But these artists always have a home at WHFR. You can tune into Spirits Rejoice Tuesdays from 6 to 10 p.m. or many of our other fine radio programs here at 89.3 WHFR Dearborn.
You're listening to the station that's making waves, WHFR, Dearborn.